From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last Saturday morning, the Shuttle Columbia was destroyed. But if you were listening to one of 1,000 automated stations programmed with a variety of formats, you might never have known.
I called both my brother-in-law and sister and told them about the shuttle. They hadn't heard about it yet.
Were they listening to the radio?
Yeah, they were listening to a country station.
For Roger Wiggs, a former radio anchor and program director turned ad consultant who lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, that call capped a morning of frustration. He woke up last Saturday to his usual station, WRAL-FM, owned by Capital Broadcasting, playing what's called a hot adult contemporary format.
I get out of the shower, and the young lady comes on after one of their three-in-a-row sets and says, "Stay tuned, we're going to be telling you more about the shuttle disaster shortly." Well, that piqued my interest. So I turned the radio up. After two or three more songs, "Stay with us, we're going to have some details of that awful tragedy on the shuttle coming up shortly." I said, "This is ridiculous." So then I started punching around the dial.
As he punched through Raleigh-Durham's top 10 radio stations, he found soft rock, hip-hop, best-of shows, almost none of it live or local. The market's only news talk station, WPTF-AM, had the story. But Wiggs ended up tethered to his cable TV for the news. He emailed his disappointment to a chat room for radio professionals called NetTalk. At radio stations everywhere, he lamented, quote, "The computers were playing hits all of the time as the nation mourned the loss of the Columbia. It would have worked out better for millions of Americans if we could have followed this important story live on radio."
They're all run by computers now. And if the shows are all voice-tracked, or either off the bird, off the satellite, nobody's in the building.
Increasingly, stations are programmed with syndicated shows taken straight off the satellite. Others are voice-tracked. That is, an announcer either in the station or far away announces the times as slated for airplay, plugs in the local weather, sets up the songs, and it sounds live. The illusion works wonders on an ordinary day. Of course, some days are not ordinary.
War does not necessarily happen Monday through Friday, 9 to 5.
Bobby Rivers writes a newsletter called The Rivers Radio Report for some 1,500 clients in the radio business. I asked him what the general feeling was in commercial radio land after the shuttle disaster.
The oldsters, as I would call some of us, were ashamed. I even had that quote several times. "I'm ashamed to be in radio. You are to serve the community." That is one of the dictates of the Federal Communications Commission. However, today, there, of course, are these lobbyists who are lobbying for mega ownership, and this mega ownership results in sometimes the inability to serve a community as it should be.
But automation was part of the radio biz long before the media giants roamed the earth, especially for the small mom-and-pop operations who couldn't afford a full-time staff.
Automation goes back to the 60s when radio stations would, owners would lock the door and walk away and leave the, you know, the great big reel-to-reel tapes rolling.
Jack Taddeo has been a programming executive for two radio conglomerates, Capstar and Clear Channel. Now he owns a mom-and-pop country station in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. In his market, there are a dozen stations, generally not owned by the giants. Only two of them covered the shuttle story in the first half hour after it broke, the News Talk AM station and his. He wasn't shocked.
A few months ago, you may recall, there was a huge pileup on I-43 in Sheboygan. You know, we made the news. You know, Sheboygan was on CNN and all the other news services and NPR and everywhere, because there was this huge pileup in the fog and several people died. And on that morning, there was a press area set up, and the two stations that were there were the full-service News Talk AM and my radio station.
Although Taddeo insists the problem is old, he concedes that it's been growing along with the media companies. Case in point, Minot, North Dakota, where all six commercial stations are owned by Clear Channel. On January 18, 2002, at around 1:30 a.m., a train derailed, spilling 300,000 gallons of deadly anhydrous ammonia. Fred DeBowie, director of dispatch for the Minot Police, said they had a new emergency alert system. It failed at both ends.
We at the police department here didn't know that the EAS equipment wasn't currently programmed. And part two of the failing of the system was that the Clear Channel station, KCJB, EAS receiver was programmed for another frequency other than the one that we are scheduled to broadcast on.
When the EAS system failed, the police called the stations, housed in two buildings. No one picked up the phone.
This went on for an hour and a half before anybody could get to anyone at the radio station to send out the word.
Alicia Mundy is senior editor of Cable World.
People got into their cars. The cars wouldn't work because the oxygen had been sucked out of the air. There were emergency vehicles, fire trucks, and ambulances by the side of the road. One man who panicked and got into his car and tried to drive away died. They had about 300 people hospitalized. There are still people now who are suffering severe burns to their lungs and haven't recovered. Some people who were made partially blind by the ammonia in the air. Livestock and pets died. It was a disaster.
I think these issues, including the anhydrous ammonia accident, ought to persuade us to be very concerned about absentee ownership, concentration of ownership.
Byron Dorgan is the Democratic senator from North Dakota. A couple of weeks ago, he raised the issue in a hearing on Capitol Hill and received a lot of support.
Much more than I expected. The public airwaves are extraordinarily valuable, and we have licensed them to be used by companies. And over time, the usage has changed very substantially, and I think the public is not getting the kind of benefit from it that they used to get.
Lisa Dollinger, Senior Vice President of Marketing and Communication for Clear Channel Radio, read us this statement.
Clear Channel radio stations are manned 24/7, regardless of market size. There is always someone in each building to cover any emergencies or technical problems that may arise.
If that person does not answer the phone, she suggests, the problem is not Clear Channel's. As for news coverage, she says any station playing a voice-tracked program in the time of breaking news is automatically switched to the network's news feed.
We go to extraordinary lengths to provide preparatory materials and training on our emergency response procedures for situations such as the Columbia tragedy. All Clear Channel radio stations were offered long-form news coverage until midnight Saturday, with updates twice hourly, long after the other news networks had ceased their coverage.
Though Clear Channel's voice-tracked programs are automatically switched, they're used only about 9% of the average broadcast day, according to Dollinger. The rest of the time, programmers have to switch manually from the station or from laptops at home. A lot of them did. A lot of them didn't. The same was true of other stations automated and owned by other companies across the country. Former anchor and programmer Roger Wiggs wonders if there's any story that's big enough to penetrate, with the speed that news demands, the automated armor of understaffed stations in hundreds of small markets. Even a story as big as, say, the assassination of a president.
If the program director's at the beach that weekend and the general manager's at his house in the Grand Cayman Islands, nobody's going to be forced to come in, turn off the voice track, and say, "Bulletin from the Associated Press. President Bush was shot this afternoon." They're going to say, and stay tuned, coming up three in a row with Barry Manilow, Faith Hill, and the Dixie Chicks.
Commercial radio listenership is dropping, but revenues are on the rise, buoyed by higher ad rates, cheaper programming, and smaller staffs. It may simply be more profitable if companies can evade the ire of Congress to keep things as they are and leave the news to the all-news stations or to public radio. And of course, there's always television.
Daddy sits on the front porch swinging, looking at
And now for some of your letters. Patricia Kimball from Pine Island, Minnesota, wrote to say, "Thank you for the story on the unseen anti-war message. No one else seems to be reporting on it, which in itself is unnerving." And Judy Livingston added, "I think yanking this ad at the last minute like that makes a very scary statement. that support for this war is more important than support for freedom of speech.
Rick Skoog, a songwriter from Nashville, Tennessee, was not as pleased with us. He wrote in with this counterpoint to our story about the illegal art show. Rick wrote, "I want to remind you that these people are using other people's property to make money. Let's say you own a house on a busy street. It's the same thing if I were to come up and start selling stuff using your property. People really have to take intellectual property seriously."
We had a lot of positive feedback on our interview with MSNBC talk show host Dan Abrams about his coverage of the disappearance of Lacey Peterson. Scott Sterling from Los Angeles wrote, "Abrams is an embarrassment to his network and a blight upon the airwaves. Maybe after your interview he won't sleep so self-satisfied. Only problem is, he's so intellectually challenged, he probably thought the interview went pretty well."
On our piece about the sports media and gay athletes, Tom Del Kiever had this to say, "I never could understand what problem jocks had with gays in the locker room. I come from an athletic family, but I spent years working as an actor sharing dressing rooms with gays. I never heard of anyone having a problem. I look forward to the day when the sports world grows up, too."
And finally, here's a tip for listeners on the lookout for the Wilhelm, that blood-curdling scream sound effect that's been slipped into movies by sound editors for half a century, most recently in Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. Careful listeners may note that we even snuck it into our sitcom about public radio called Pledge This. If you want to hear the Wilhelm for yourself, just go to the website created by Steve Lee called HollywoodLostAndFound.net.
And keep the letters coming. Write to us at onthemedia.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Coming up, Al Jazeera confronts some competition, Indonesia wrestles with media regulation, and community radio brings power to the people in India.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For the last 2 years, Al Jazeera, the satellite news channel backed by the Kingdom of Qatar, has been synonymous with pan-Arab TV. But the most established broadcast voice in the region has long been MBC, the Middle Eastern Broadcast Company, a Saudi-backed mixture of news, sports, and entertainment. As the world prepares for a showdown in Iraq, MBC is spinning off its own 24-hour satellite channel called Al Arabiya. But why? In the complicated kabuki theater of Arab politics, there is more to the story than just business competition. Joining us to discuss the Arab TV landscape is Jihad Fakhreddin, media analyst for the Pan-Arab Research Center in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Mr. Fakhreddin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Why do you suppose we seldom hear about MBC here in the West, and Al Jazeera is the focus of all the attention?
There are many reasons. Probably one of them was the Bin Laden tapes that have been shown on Al Jazeera may have played a big role. But NBC is a general programming channel that has entertainment and news. This may have diluted the image of NBC as a provider of news.
To what extent will this channel be a propaganda tool for the Saudi king and princes to stay in power and maintain their legitimacy?
I think your question is not relevant here, because NBC is certainly known to be the most moderate Arab station that an Arab could watch. Remember, NBC had its headquarters for the last 10 years in London, and it has learned a lot from the Western style of journalism.
As you look at the media scene, as you look at Al Jazeera and NBC and other broadcast voices throughout the Arab world, do you see something missing, or are you satisfied that the television audiences throughout the Arab world are being well served?
I think what is missing is investigative reporting. We have a lot of talk shows and news programs, but less of investigative reporting that deals with social, political, economic, and cultural issues that are relevant to our life. Maybe it's missing because once you start touching on these, then you are touching on some raw nerves that may not make many happy. So they settle for talk shows.
Is there a structural problem there that these stations and networks are subsidized or supported in whole by regimes that themselves are of dubious legitimacy, that by encouraging investigative reporting, the owners of the station risk damaging their very masters?
Oh, you are using very harsh terms. I'm not sure they are as appropriate as you are describing them.
Well, there's an expression that he who pays the piper calls the tune. The owners are part of the Saudi establishment.
I mean, I'd rather stick to general issues rather than questions related to regimes, because it doesn't help me or it doesn't help you. I mean, I understand your perspective, and I understand the way many feel towards the Saudi Arabia, you know, but I mean, definitely it's not the terminologies that we use in this part of the world to describe governments or states or relationship between media and the government.
Among the many criticisms of Al Jazeera is
Yes? The
insinuation by some that it is being used by the Kingdom of Qatar, which subsidizes it, to deflect attention from Qatar's own arrangements with the West, particularly the United States, and particularly in preparation for the impending war against Iraq. And it's been further suggested that NBC and the Saudis are launching their 24-hour news channel to reflect attention back on Qatar and away from the Saudis' dealings with the West in preparation for the invasion of Iraq. Is that what's happening here? Is that the subtext, or are these strictly business propositions, pure and simple?
Well, there is a degree of business proposition in it, especially with the NBC. It has the highest share of ad spend in the region. But, I mean, trying to snipe at each other in terms of which one is more supportive of the U.S., I think both are. What happens is that the channel itself may not say something about the U.S. presence in Qatar, or NBC may not say something about the American presence in Saudi Arabia, but the people on the talk shows definitely are very eloquent and articulate in attacking the American presence in the region, regardless in which country it is and regardless on which channel they are talking.
Very well. Well, Shehad Fakhreddin, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Shehad Fakhreddin is the research manager for media at the Pan-Arab Research Center in Dubai. During the three decades of Suharto's repressive regime in Indonesia, the media were fiercely controlled. In 1998, Suharto was ousted, and reform led to a boom in newspapers, television, and radio. For 4 years, the media in Indonesia flourished. Recently, the Indonesian parliament passed a law to take media ownership out of the hands of Suharto-era cronies in Jakarta and increase regional television. The Economist's Edward McBride reported on the new law from Jakarta and predicts that dismantling the old guard won't make it easier for regional TV.
all the wealth in Indonesia, like the political power, is still concentrated in Jakarta. And so the government was hoping both to increase the ownership of media outlets, of television stations in particular, around Indonesia, also to increase the diversity of opinions, and at the same time, hopefully, get rid of some of the Suharto cronies who still dominate the media sector. So that intention, at least, was a good one.
What was the mechanism? If they want to increase the diversity of ownership and have more diversity of expression, how do you do that?
What they did was they said that every television station could only be licensed for a particular province. Indonesia is a huge country. It's as big east to west as America. It has over 30 provinces, but there's no such thing now under the new media law as a nationwide television license. Those nationwide licenses that already existed, or there were 10 of them, were scrapped. And instead, now, each TV company will only be allowed to broadcast in one province of Indonesia. The idea is that each province will therefore get new companies who will broadcast only in that province and reflect the ideas and opinions of the people living there.
I can see how that kind of regulation is well-intended, but it also seemed to me that one of the obvious consequences is that whoever bought a station that had a national reach, corrupt or not corrupt, this person would suddenly have a license that's worth a whole lot less if it can only serve a single province. How did the media owners react?
That's right. There were 10 companies with nationwide licenses. They didn't actually pay for the licenses, but obviously they did build business plans. They took loans out from the bank on the idea that they'd be able to sell advertising and gain revenue from all around the country. All of a sudden, they can't.
As a practical matter, is there any market for regional stations in Indonesia? Is anybody going to pony up the money to have such a limited reach?
Presumably now, if you're going to make the investment to set up a TV station, you want to do it in the big lucrative markets, and that is Jakarta, maybe one or two other cities, but certainly not the neglected regions that the law was designed to help.
In the brief golden age from 1998 to 2002 of a flourishing media in Indonesia, do you believe that it had a net positive effect on trends towards democracy?
On the whole, simply the idea that Indonesians would be exposed to lots of different opinions and have a chance to debate these issues in public is an enormous change, a change that was warmly welcomed by the Indonesians as one they themselves would point to as one of the most significant, if not the most significant, democratic changes since Suharto's fall.
So what's the moral of this story?
The moral would be that it's all very well and good to reform the broadcasting laws, but you have to make sure that you're balancing the ideals of your reform, in this case, the ideal of increasing the diversity of voices in the media, with the practicalities of it. And in modern, latter-day Indonesia, the practicalities are simply that the money, the businessmen willing to invest in television in particular, live in Jakarta. A lot of those people have ties to the old regime. If you want to get television business going, you're going to have to make some kind of compromise between allowing those people to continue to participate in the business and putting up with some of the political baggage that goes along with that.
Okay. Edward McBride, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Edward McBride is a reporter for The Economist magazine. He spoke to us from Jakarta, Indonesia.
Television is rarely seen in the far reaches of Gujarat, a state in western India, and rarer still in an impoverished desert region there called Kutch, where villagers may trek miles to find the day's water. Twice the size of New Jersey and sparsely populated, Kutch is isolated from the rest of India largely because it shares a porous border with India's bitter rival, Pakistan. TVs may be unaffordable, but every Kutchy village has a radio. From Gujarat, reporter Miranda Kennedy has the story.
This is the music that calls villagers from the field every Sunday evening to gather around the village radio at a tea stall here in the barren terrain of Kutch. Radio Ujus is how it's known to locals. The people here speak a dialect called Kutchy, which has no written script. Most Kutchys live their lives without needing to write more than their name. They work as farmers, laborers, fishermen, or housewives. The literacy rate among women is lower than 1% in some parts of the region. It is these statistics that gave the grassroots women's group Kutch Vikas Mahila Sangathan, or KVMS, the idea of a rural radio show. KVMS joined together with a group of media professionals, bought airtime from the state-owned radio, which has an almost complete monopoly over India's airwaves, and taught themselves the ins and outs of producing radio. Priti Soni grew up in a Kutchi village. She is now the producer of Radio Ujjas.
So, aisa kyun na koi aisa madhyam ho jiske zariye hum jo ek drishtikon hai ya to jo gaon ke prashn hai isko uthaya jaye.
All India Radio has only one program in our language, so we wanted to create something that villagers could understand and relate to. We had no model to look to anywhere in India. The villages in Kutch are hundreds of kilometers apart. We wanted to link them and talk about real issues that people face but that they don't talk about in the open.
Gaon ki mahilaon ka aur gaon se ek mang to thi.
It began as a serialized weekly radio soap opera that drew heavily on Kutchi folklore. Its main star was a Siberian crane, popular in Kutchi mythology, with a bird's-eye view over the thousand-some villages of the region. Stalin Kay is one of the founders of Radio Ujjas. He works with the Drishti Media Collective, a group of media professionals based in Ahmedabad, Gujarat's largest city. He says one of the greatest challenges of the project was finding ways to get unorthodox ideas across to a highly traditional village audience.
The first program was not overtly radical because there are certain ground rules being laid down. One, it is going to take a feminist stand, but never alienate the men. You have characters who are rebellious, but they can't be completely misplaced and unidentifiable. So the radical thing, for example, in Kunjal, one of the radical things was that there is this woman's head of the council whose daughter has decided that she'll not get married. You know, that's radical.
After 3 years, the project has transformed into a vibrant weekly magazine. The show still has a dramatized serial, but now it's followed by an investigative reporting section and a travelogue that explores Kutchi history and arts. The segments are linked by indigenous folk songs sung by local musicians. It's the first broadcast to ever reach every corner of the region, and almost two-thirds of the Kutchi population now tunes into the program. The chief aim of Radio Ujjas is teaching media skills to villagers, particularly women. For the investigative exposé section, the group recruited 15 reporters from Kutchi villages and taught them basic journalism. Most are school dropouts in their early 20s. Half of the reporters are women. Nimi Chauhan of the Drishti Media Collective explains.
We wanted the local people to be able to do it themselves. They should not keep on relying on us all the time. Whatever we have, we should part the skills to them so that they can further in turn part it to somebody else. And that's how truly you can become community radio.
The most popular segment on Radio Ujjas is the muckraking investigative expose. The segment name, Parda Fash, literally means lifting the veil. The Radio Ujjas reporters share two mini-disc recorders, which they take into the field to conduct interviews. They have learned how to work with digital editing software, which is installed in their studio in Bhuj, the capital of Kutch. Every week, they meet with a KVMS editorial committee to come up with what to cover. Dozens of village problems have been solved after they were made public on Radio Ujjas. Bhati Ahmed Bachu is a 52-year-old fisherman who, along with hundreds of other fishermen, was being evicted from his district by a port expansion project. The company forbade them to fish or live in the area. Bachu, like many tribal villagers in India, occupies land that has been in his family for generations, but for which he holds no deed.
They asked us to vacate lock, stock, and barrel without any proper resettlement and compensation. Where could we go aside from another seashore, since we are fishermen? When we filed a case for wrongful eviction, they fabricated charges against us, but it is not their land. Though we don't have any proof of its ownership, we have been living there for centuries. There was no one to hear our grievances, so the radio program was a godsend for us.
Bachu went on a hunger fast and refused to vacate the land, but no one paid him any mind until a Radio Ujjas reporter got wind of the story and put Bachu on the air. KVMS helped Bachu take his case to court, and the company was forced to come up with alternative resettlement plans for the fishermen. For many villagers, the radio project has also brought personal transformation.
When I heard the program, it helped me become aware and made me think that radio is a good way to try to find some justice.
Rahima Ben Salambai is a reporter in Mundra village. She went to school until she was 14. Now, at age 37, she is the oldest reporter in the group. She is also one of the rare Kutchi village women who separated from her husband, which she did only recently after getting involved with KVMS. Because her husband has a problem with alcohol, she decided to investigate alcoholism and abuse in Kutch.
Many women came together for a meeting in my village, and I interviewed them about the menace of liquor that the village is facing. Some 20 women agreed to speak to me about how the men drink away their money. Then the women unanimously appealed to the village head to stop the flow of liquor in the village.
2 years ago, an earthquake ravaged the region, killing almost 20,000 people. Virtually every building in Kutch was damaged, including the radio studio in Buj. But widespread corruption and neglect have prevented most of the houses from being rebuilt. A few months after the quake, Radio Ujus started airing an earthquake relief information program after convincing an electronics company to donate 1,000 radios to Kutchi villagers. The program was called You Are Alive. Priti Soni, producer of Radio Ujus.
You can really see the program's impact in the village of Suraniban. There, the village head and a bank official joined hands to deduct money from every Kutchi's compensation for the houses they lost in the earthquake. They collected hundreds of thousands of rupees for themselves that way. We exposed it on the air, forcing the village head to apologize and return the money. When we do this kind of exposing, it's really uplifting for the villagers because they see that there is a way to make their voices heard and deal with their problems.
Radio Ujus has gained such a reputation that sometimes when a reporter starts sniffing around a village, the problem will be cleared up before she can even come back to report on it. The word Ujus means light in Kutchi. The Radio Ujus project is inspiring other nascent community radio projects cropping up around rural India. For On the Media, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Kutch, Gujarat.
Coming up, Time Magazine's shady subscription deals and why a U.S. court had to decide whether the X-Men are human.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, in a network exclusive, a paranoid, reclusive man opened up his palace to an unassuming Englishman and the prying eyes of the world media.
Peter Pan, to me, he represents youth, never growing up, magic.
You don't want to grow up.
No, I am Peter Pan.
You're not your Michael Jackson.
I'm Peter Pan, my heart.
Well, the king of pop did speak with British journalist Martin Bashir on ABC, but he wasn't the recluse I was referring to.
Please tell the British people, if the Iraqis are subject to aggression or humiliation, They will fight bravely and steadily, just as the British people fought in the Second World War to defend their country.
Iraqi President Saddam Hussein spoke with Tony Benn, a former British left-wing MP, in an 11th-hour attempt to sway global opinion in his favor. The interview was bought by Channel 4 in Britain and CBS here in the States. Fawaz Jurgis is the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College, and he watched excerpts of the interview when it was broadcast on 60 Minutes, too. Fawaz, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, if you were Saddam Hussein and you were trying to cultivate the anti-war movement in the West, would you have made the choice of opening your palace up to Tony Benn, who has made a career being an anti-war activist and who has expressed, if not sympathy to his regime, a certain tolerance that is probably not shared by the average Briton? Would you have called in a Tony Benn or a Wolf Blitzer, for example?
What we need to understand, because of his obsession with security, he knows Tony Benn. Tony Benn went to Iraq during the 1991 crisis with the United States. But Tony Benn is not a journalist. Tony Benn is an activist. I mean, he basically starts with the premise that Iraq is not guilty, that Saddam Hussein's views can be swayed.
One of the most conspicuous aspects of the interview is how inconspicuous it was, certainly in the American media. Excerpts were run on 60 Minutes, too, but it wasn't as though everybody stopped in their tracks to see what Saddam Hussein would have to say. Were you surprised by how little attention the interview seemed to generate?
No, I was not surprised at all. The media have not taken the time to tell the American audience about the Iraqi perspective. I think the media have joined the establishment's attempt to demonize the man. The man is a bloody dictator, no doubts about it. But at the same time, we need to listen to what the Iraqis have to say. You know, what amazes me, Bob, is that the American media interview Kuwaitis, Saudi Arabians, Egyptian scholars. How many Iraqi professors have we interviewed?
And yet, if you're doing an interview and you know with a certainty that the interviewee will express pro-regime points of view, because to do the opposite would mean imprisonment or death, why go through the exercise to begin with?
Well, first of all, because we are giving the administration all the time in the world. And the administration perspective is that the Iraqi regime is guilty, period. And secondly, it's a question of balance. No one is suggesting that the media should defend Saddam Hussein. There is a great deal of blood on Saddam Hussein's hands. But this is what democracy is all about.
Now, you've said that you're disappointed that the interview didn't get more play and attention in the West. Did that have something to do with the fact that the Iraqis sold the program to the highest bidder, CBS, which has been loath to distribute it elsewhere?
Partly. I think the Iraqi regime has been extremely inept in trying to use the media as an effective weapon in its campaign to change world public opinion. Let's remember, Iraq did its cause a considerable damage in 1990-1991 when it kept a tight lid on the flow of information of Iraq. In fact, the United States was able to use the media very effectively during the war in 1991. But I doubt very much whether Saddam Hussein would be able to capitalize by using this interview because of the question of credibility. Because of the question also that I think the world already sympathizes with Iraq, but at the same time, they would like to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
Well, Fawaz, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Bob.
Fawaz Jurgis is the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle East Studies at Sarah Lawrence College and author of America and Political Islam, A Clash of Cultures or Clash of Interests.
On the Media has learned that the Time Inc. magazine group is now the focus of a multi-state investigation into the company's subscription sales and marketing practices. The Florida Attorney General's office has just alerted Time officials that 13 other states, including New York, Texas, Pennsylvania, and Illinois, have joined in its ongoing inquiry into the way that firm sells its publications, including Money, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, and Time. Investigators are focusing on Time's use of a billing technique called automatic renewal. Among the possible infractions are a lack of clear and conspicuous disclosure on bills, a pattern of threatening collection letters for unfounded subscription charges, and the use of sales pitches disguised as invoices. This is not good news for Time. 3 years ago, after a similar type of multi-state investigation, Time was forced to stop using its "You May Be a Winner" direct mail promotion under threat of severe legal penalties. Last March, only Florida was looking into Time's use of automatic renewal, but OTM's John Solomon was on the case.
After a year of subscribing to Money Magazine, 76-year-old Jack Eldridge of Plano, Texas, decided not to renew. But soon after the expiration date, Eldridge began receiving increasingly urgent overdue notices. Chalking it up to computer error, he ignored the correspondence. That is, until he received a letter threatening, quote, "further serious collection activities against you by Time Inc., including being placed in the Time Inc. bad debt file." That scared Eldridge enough that he sent in a check, along with his own letter, demanding that they stop sending the magazine.
I have a good credit rating, and I didn't want to sallied by such a cheap shot.
Computer error was not responsible for filling Eldridge's mailbox. Instead, it turns out that he had unwittingly agreed to join Time's preferred subscriber's automatic renewal program, which obligated him to a continuous subscription until he canceled it. Though it is a major change from the traditional magazine billing method, Eldridge would only have figured out he'd been signed up by seeing the small type, obliquely worded explanation hidden far down in the original bill. Florida Assistant Attorney General Victoria Butler says this level of disclosure may violate state law.
It's reasonable to hold a consumer to the terms of an offer that they accepted if those terms are made clearly and conspicuously and responsibly to the consumer. It's not reasonable to hold them to an obligation that the company is tricking them into.
Butler, who is based in Tampa, where Time's circulation operations are headquartered, has received hundreds of similar complaints from across the U.S. Based on previous experience in consumer cases, she believes that may just be the tip of the iceberg. Many are from long-time subscribers who say Time changed the renewal terms without their knowledge and then hounded them for payment when they let their subscriptions expire.
We're talking about 6, 7, 8 months of pointed collection notices that get increasingly threatening, this Time Warner bad debt database, this black cloud on their name. Nobody quite understands the full implications of that. I mean, that threat is very real and very serious as far as what the company is doing under the law.
Automatic renewal is an attempt by the Time Magazine Group to change its billing to the continuous service model used by sister AOL Time Warner businesses such as cable and internet service. From a business point of view, it is understandable why Time would want to change the renewal process. The trouble, from a legal standpoint, is that the company is not telling their subscribers about the change, except in fine print. And they are never explicitly asked whether they prefer to be preferred subscribers. Time spokesperson Peter Castiglio did not want to be interviewed on air, but told On the Media that there's nothing illegal or wrong with the company's sales practices. Castiglio says that automatic renewal is clearly explained on bills and points out that the complaints make up just a fraction of the magazine group's total subscribers. Further, he says, it is easy for customers to cancel their subscriptions, no questions asked. Butler agrees that Time is responsive to customers when they call to complain. The problem is that the company will not modify the policy that is generating the confusion.
It's not right what they're doing because they're taking advantage of people who don't read the fine print or who are easily confused. Whether or not it was illegal, it felt unethical, definitely.
To former customer service representative Chris Durham, Time is making a calculation that there are enough people like Jack Eldridge who will respond to pressure tactics by just paying up. Durham says that most of the calls he took during the 7 months he worked at Time's Tampa call center in 2000 were from consumers bewildered as to why they were getting collection letters.
We got a lot of people calling up and say, "Hey, my grandma has subscriptions to Sports Illustrated. Why is that?"
Victoria Butler says the answer may lie in another Time marketing technique, direct mail sales pieces made to look like invoices. She's looking into whether they are being sent out by Time without the requisite 30-point bold-face no-obligation disclaimer mandated by Florida law. John S. Reed, a retired police officer, says he was almost fooled by one such look-alike pitch from Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, I'm 64 years old myself, and I'm fairly sharp, I think, yet. But I can see where some people that have physical and mental problems when they get into our age group, and some of them would ordinarily pay this. And Time Life is a big enough corporation that they don't have to stoop to this type of practice in order to get money from people.
If time is found to be in violation of Florida law, it could incur significant fines and be forced to provide refunds. The company also faces a private lawsuit filed by a subscriber in Tampa, which will likely become a class action. Assistant Attorney General Butler is currently awaiting Time's response to her request for billing materials and records before deciding whether to pursue charges. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
If you are a toy, being too human can cost you. So when the X-Men came before the U.S. Court of International Trade, its progenitors were pleased when the judges ruled that the X-Men are not men. In fact, they aren't human at all. Dolls command higher tariffs than mere toys, so the ruling helps Toy Biz, Inc. and Marvel Enterprises sell X-Men figures cheaper. But outside of reality, fans were disturbed, because the X-Men are most beloved not for their mutant powers, but for their human flaws. Brian Wilkinson is the editor of the website X-Fan. He told the Wall Street Journal that it is unthinkable to label the X-Men, those fighters of prejudice, anything but human. He joins me now from Toronto. So, Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, you want to summarize for listeners who don't know, who are the X-Men?
It's a comic that was created by Stan Lee in the early 60s. Basically, they're normal people like you and I who, around puberty, develop extra powers, wings, lasers, flight, whatever. Basically, they're just hunted and persecuted by humanity for being different.
Right. But like all other Marvel characters, they're distinguished for their human qualities, right? In fact, we do an unreasonable amount, I think it's fair to say, of Marvel coverage on this program. We reported that the Thing from the Fantastic Four was Jewish and that the first Captain America was black. And of course, I don't even have to inform our listeners that the Rawhide Kid just came out of the closet. So what is the key element about the humanity of the X-Men that you might want to raise?
Basically, being human is the foundation of the Marvel Universe. What made Spider-Man, for instance, so interesting when it debuted was that Peter Parker had troubles. He was a troubled teenager. The X-Men, they get married, they have affairs, trouble within their own homes, all the normal issues that go along with being human. And the idea is basically that readers will feel more for these characters, they'll be in more touch, and actually they'll be more devoted if they can buy that these are people that could potentially really exist.
And the source of most of the X-Men's trouble and strife is the fact that their humanity is always being called into question by those who would persecute them.
Yeah, and if you think about it, if there were such a thing as mutants in the real world, that's exactly what would happen.
I think the American people deserve the right to decide whether they want their children to be in school with mutants, to be taught by mutants. Ladies and gentlemen, the truth is that mutants are very real, and they are among us. We must know who they are, and above all, we must know what they can do.
We've seen it happen for decades, for centuries, that if someone is different than you, and you can't immediately explain it, and you can't immediately understand it, then your natural reaction is to hate and fear that. And what the X-Men do is they try to raise awareness of who they are through good deeds around the world and through corporations and everything else so that people can just come to accept them for who they are.
And speaking of corporations, why did the U.S. Court of International Trade rule recently on whether the X-Men were human?
Well, it's kind of funny. It had been a longstanding battle between a company called Toy Biz, which actually owns Marvel Comics, and it was about toy trade. Basically, the X-Men toys, though human-like in appearance and everything else, were called dolls. Dolls are defined as something being human-like in appearance. And dolls earn a trade tariff of 12% when you ship it across the border. Now, if they're just merely toys, not dolls, then it's only 6%. So basically, the argument by Toy Biz is, well, no, these are superhuman characters. They've got wings and everything else. They're distinctly non-human-like in appearance. And basically, it's just about them trying to recoup some financial loss.
Now, Toy Biz, in this case, is representing Marvel Enterprises, which stands to gain from a lower tariff, right?
Oh, yes.
And so what you're basically saying is that Marvel is kowtowing to the corporate man.
Yeah, well, a little bit. But what you have to understand is Marvel has been bankrupt. They've had no money. So part of this decision is really just to keep the company going.
And so what did the judge decide?
Well, the judge basically ruled that the X-Men are not human. In other words, they're not dolls, they're toys. One of them had vibrating powers, others had wings. So the judge said, well, I can't really describe these as being human-like.
Well, the one with vibrating powers you could probably describe as all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah, well.
Well, I mean, what did Marvel have to say about the fact that with this decision they may have gained the world but lost their souls?
I don't really think they'd feel that way. I think it's just a standard part of being a big corporation. I don't think they themselves really even personally have much to do with it, you know, like the editors and the president.
Yeah, but the fans seem to be following it. You have, anyway.
But again, it's just because of the nature of it, because they were ruled as not human, and because fans are so used to them trying to be human, that really was what made it interesting for us.
Interesting or outrageous?
Well, it is outrageous. It's outrageous, one, because we're talking about toys. I mean, at the end of the day, really, it's just about toys. So it's kind of outrageous in that respect that they've gone to such lengths. And it's also outrageous to fans because we're kind of surprised that Marvel might back a statement like that they're not human. I don't know. At the end of the day, it's toys. And basically, whatever keeps the company going, really, will keep fans happier in the long run. So we can't be too upset.
And for you, the fact that these are just little plastic models of these characters doesn't really sully the purity of the originals.
Well, no. I mean, I'm a big kid. I've picked up a lot of the toys. For me, it's just nice to have the miniature representation of the comic book characters, but it's funny how attached you get to these things. I've been reading the X-Men for about 13 years now. I've been with them through all their highs and lows, and even though they may have been passed through the hands of a dozen writers, you really just get to know who they are. It doesn't make any sense, but you get into it.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
Brian Wilkinson joined me from his home in Toronto. His site is XFan, and we'll link you to it from our site at onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Brian Tilley. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
One of them had vibrating powers.
Support from the media is provided by the Bydale Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.